the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 10th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. There's a fair amount of coverage of the anniversary of the derecho today. I will read as much of it as I have time for. We'll start today with an article titled, Bus Drivers Union Gives CR Schools an F, Eastern Iowa in Need of More Drivers as First Day of School Approaches, by Grace King. As schools struggle to find adequate staffing for their buses, a local union gave the Cedar Rapids Community School District an F grade on fair treatment of bus drivers. Teamsters Local 238 union members spoke Monday during the Cedar Rapids School Board meeting. They asked school officials to reinstate language that was stripped from the Cedar Rapids School Bus Union contract a few years ago, said Jesse Case, Secretary Treasurer and Principal Officer of Teamsters Local 238, Iowa's largest local union. The union would like to see bargaining reinstated over modified workdays such as school closures, delayed starts and early dismissals, leaves of absence such as illness or disability leave, jury duty and bereavement leave, holidays, health provisions, and safety. This language was removed in 2017 from Iowa Code when the legislature rewrote the state's collective bargaining law. The change allows public employers to voluntarily bargain over formerly mandatory topics. At the time, Brad Buck was superintendent of the Cedar Rapids Community School District. It's appalling the district is so tone-deaf, they're driving their own employees away, Case said, calling the district's treatment of school bus drivers disrespectful. There's 40 years of labor relations history in this district, which is now broken, Case said. Linda Nagel, Cedar Rapids Executive Director for Talent Management, said the district has continued to negotiate in good faith with all unions, including the Teamsters, representing employees in the transportation department. Any language that was moved from the collective bargaining agreement to the employee handbook occurred only as a result of agreement between the district and the Teamsters, Nagel said in an email Tuesday to the Gazette. The district did not take steps to strip the contract, as this change was done through the mutual negotiations process, Nagel said. Additionally, any language that was removed from the collective bargaining agreement was put into an employee handbook so that transportation employees continued to receive the same employee benefits they have previously received. Over the last 5 years, the district has honored every written agreement entered into with the Teamsters, and the Teamsters have not filed any grievances under the collective bargaining agreement nor any complaints under the employee handbook, Nagel said. Bus drivers were not paid when the district canceled 4 days of summer school programming in July because of a cybersecurity breach. Sally Schaub, a school van driver since 2019, said bus drivers paid the price for the cybersecurity breach. It's one thing to lose pay, Schaub said during public comment at Monday's meeting. But when asked if we would be paid, we were informed we are supplemental employees. We were demoralized. We have to feel that we're valuable. Scott Puntany, business agent with Teamsters Local 238, said the Cedar Rapids School Board and superintendent are not worker-friendly. My guess is you support unions when it's convenient to you, when you want endorsements or to give you credibility in the community, Puntany said during public comment. When it comes to caring for workers and treating them with the dignity and respect they deserve, you forget about the promises you made. Transportation employees told the Gazette about 60 bus drivers are hired to drive Cedar Rapids students, and 20 more are needed. Less than 2 weeks before the first day of school, the district implemented a new route mapping system after the previous system was disrupted by the cybersecurity breach. Systems that diagnose mechanical issues for school buses were also affected, transportation employees said. In an email to the Gazette last week, Nagel said, there is a nationwide staff shortage in school districts, and Cedar Rapids is no exception. In these challenging times, our building administrators and teachers step up to determine how to best serve students in the community, Nagel said. The district is implementing short and long-term strategies to close the staffing gap, including offering extra incentives, building substitute pools, asking retired teachers to return, and combining classes if needed. CR man charged more than a month after protesters hit, by Trish Mahaffey. A Cedar Rapids man was charged Tuesday with assaulting protesters as he drove his vehicle aggressively toward the group who were on foot crossing the street near the federal courthouse on June 24th. David Allen Houston, 53, was charged with assault by use or display of a dangerous weapon, vehicle, an aggravated misdemeanor, and leaving the scene of a personal injury accident. Houston will be prosecuted by the Blackhawk County Attorney's Office following an investigation by the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Blackhawk County Attorney Brian Williams said last month he was reviewing the case because at least one member of the Linn County Attorney's Office was present during the incident and could be a witness. The case will be tried in Linn County, Williams said in a statement Tuesday. A complaint hasn't been filed in Linn County, but Williams said in a news release that as protesters crossed 2nd Street Southeast near the U.S. District Courthouse in downtown Cedar Rapids, Houston approached the protesters in his truck. Although Mr. Houston had a green light, he appears to aggressively approach with his vehicle while the protesters remained on foot, Williams said. Other vehicles in the area appear to simply wait for the protesters. Williams said there isn't any evidence to show this was politically motivated or any evidence that the protesters were aggressive in any way during the incident. Police previously said they had surveillance video of the area where demonstrators gathered at 7:17 p.m. to protest the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling against abortion rights earlier that day. Videos posted on social media showed a truck with its window rolled down and what appeared to be a driver exchanging words with several protesters as the vehicle was moving forward. Police, after the incident, interviewed the injured woman who was taken to a hospital for possible treatment and the driver. Williams didn't identify any protesters being injured. As I crossed the street, I heard a commotion, Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker recalled in an interview after the incident. I turned back to see a truck driving into the crowd with at least two young women, one of whom is a Linn County staffer, directly in front of the vehicle, and another woman appeared to be engaged with a vehicle near the driver's side. Walker said he believed the vehicle had no intention of stopping, so he ran to try to help. The driver accelerated and injured several young women in the process, Walker said. Thankfully, the women in front of the vehicle were not run over. Video posted on social media captured the truck's personalized license plate. Police said the driver was voluntarily interviewed but didn't say whether that was at the scene or later. Marion gets $3 million for Central Plaza, Destination Iowa grant funded by Federal American Rescue Plan, by Gage Miskiman. Marion will receive $3 million of Federal American Rescue Plan funds allocated by the state toward its Central Plaza project in City Square Park. Governor Kim Reynolds' office announced the Destination Iowa grant funding Tuesday, with the Marion project being one of three to receive funds in this round of allocations, which includes $12.5 million to the city of Dyersville toward a planned baseball stadium on the Field of Dreams movie site. The Central Plaza at City Square Park in the heart of Uptown Marion has been in the works since the city's visioning process in 2018. The project is expected to begin after the Uptown Marion 7th Avenue streetscape project and North Plaza on 11th Street, which is expected to be completed this year. Mayor Nick Abuasali said the city is thrilled. We view it as an endorsement of our leading role in creating great places that make Marion and our region desirable destinations for people and businesses, Abuasali said. The Central Plaza will be another point of pride and a testament to what a community can accomplish when we believe more in our own potential and reach higher together to achieve amazing things. The park's redesign includes an area that can be transformed into an ice skating rink during the winter, an artistic peace tree to be the city's holiday centerpiece, flexible outdoor seating, water features, play structure, event stage, and space for festival and market tents. The park's historic train depot that has become a central piece of Uptown Marion also may see some upgrades, including a potential warming house during the winter, restrooms and mechanical rooms for the various water features. City Manager Ryan Waller said getting the award doesn't change the project timeline. He said that bidding will happen at the end of this year or early next year, and then construction should begin in the spring or early summer of next year. The timeline stays the same because everything has synced up nicely, he said. Timing couldn't be any more perfect for us. The award represents 40% of the total project investment of $9,014,000, according to the state's news release. The city sought $3.5 million overall to also help with the CMAR Trail project, but was not awarded that portion of the funding request. Last month, Linn and Blackhawk counties received $3.5 million of a Federal American Rescue Plan funds allocated by the state to finish paving the last 16 miles of the Cedar Valley Nature Trail that runs between Evansville and Hiawatha. Dyersville received $12.5 million for Field of Dreams project, its largest single grant to date from Destination Iowa, by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Dyersville will receive $12.5 million in federal funding from the state toward a planned baseball stadium on the Field of Dreams movie site, part of a broad baseball and tourism project planned on the site. According to a release from Governor Kim Reynolds, the money will go toward the This Is Iowa Ballpark, a multi-use $50 million stadium on the set of the 1989 film. I am grateful and proud that we were able to secure that funding, Dyersville Mayor Jeff Jake said. It's a great down payment, and it will help to raise some more funds when we have that much money already set aside for the project. The announcement, which accounts for 25% of the stadium's funding, came in the latest round of grants from Destination Iowa and is the largest single grant by the program to date. The program is a $100 million fund set up to promote tourism and attract new residents to Iowa using federal pandemic relief money from the American Rescue Plan Act. Destination Iowa has granted more than $37 million to tourism and economic development projects around the state across three rounds of funding this year. The stadium is part of a larger $80 million project that will include nine fields for youth baseball, a hotel, event space, an RV park, and an amphitheater. The project is being developed by Go the Distance Baseball LLC, which owns the Field of Dreams site. The City of Dyersville approved up to $9.5 million in tax increment financing for the complex in July, according to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. Jake said the city and the company behind the project are searching for private investors and sponsors to reach the $50 million cost of the project. Suspect sought in road rage shooting. No injuries reported after CR incident. By Emily Anderson. Cedar Rapids police said they are investigating a shooting that stemmed from road rage Monday near the corner of Underwood Avenue and Burdett Drive Southwest. In a news release, police said officers were called to the scene a little before 5 p.m. for a report that shots were being fired from one vehicle toward another vehicle. Officers found evidence of a shooting, including property damage to a nearby home, but no suspects or vehicles. After a short search, an uninjured victim was found, the release said. That person told police the shots were fired after a road rage incident. Police are asking anyone with security footage that may help identify the shooter or their vehicle to reach out to investigators at 319-286-5491. DeGeer calls for three debates by the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Deidre DeGeer, the Democratic candidate for Iowa governor, on Tuesday called on Republican incumbent Governor Kim Reynolds to participate in at least three debates before the November 8th election. At a news conference near the Iowa Capitol, DeGeer said her campaign has accepted at least three invitations from media outlets and advocacy organizations that are hosting debates or candidate forums and has been in discussions with more. When we talk about all political power being inherent in the people's way is through democracy and exercising their right to vote, and the people deserve myself and our current governor on a stage, DeGeer said at the news conference. Reynolds' campaign spokesman said the governor is happy to debate and that details will be ironed out as fall approaches. Rick Stewart, the Libertarian Party candidate for governor, posted on social media his own debate challenge to DeGeer, calling on her to reject any offers from debates that do not also include him. New Regents Company approved as vendor for Iowa Public Universities, but more strict rules apply because it's a conflict of interest vendor. By Vanessa Miller. Each of Iowa's public universities has approved as a conflict of interest vendor, Seneca Companies, Inc., which the state's newest regent heads as president and chief operating officer. Governor Kim Reynolds in June appointed J.C. Ryswick to fill a vacancy on the Board of Regents, which governs the University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa. A review by the Gazette found the UI spent or committed to spend a total of $125,899 with Des Moines-based Seneca over the last 3 years, before Ryswick's appointment. A letter the Board of Regents office sent Ryswick on Monday outlining a plan for university contracting with Seneca going forward indicates he can't have access to information regarding any proposed transaction with a regent institution that is not otherwise available to the public. Additionally, in your role as a member of the Board of Regents, you shall not participate in any discussions or decisions regarding a proposed transaction involving Seneca Companies, Inc. and a regent institution, according to the letter. Where UI, for example, typically doesn't have to publicly bid work under $50,000, a conflict of interest vendor triggers a lower threshold. The bid threshold for approved conflict of interest vendors is $2,000, according to the board letter. Therefore, all transactions for an amount greater or equal to $2,000 are required to be competitively bid before an order can be placed with your business. Additionally, state law requires a disclosure form to be filed with the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board, within 20 days of a Regent Institution transaction with Seneca. The board office will provide support and assistance in the timely completion and filing of this disclosure form, according to the letter. Other rules that apply for conflict of interest vendors. Work cannot begin and goods can't be shipped without a purchase order number or a professional services agreement and corresponding purchase order signed by a chief procurement officer. No payments can be made without an authorized purchase order. Universities can't use procurement cards to pay conflict of interest vendors, regardless of the amount. Now, moving on to some of the derecho coverage. This article is titled, 2 years of fights with insurance, a nightmare. 4,700 out of 225,000 derecho-related claims still open, by Aaron Murphy. 2 years after the devastating effects of the 2020 derecho, the crack in the concrete foundation of Mark Sutton's home still needs to be repaired, and the house still needs to be rewired. Damage to the siding has not been repaired, nor has the punctured siding or cracked door on his detached garage. Sutton said it has been a nonstop battle over insurance, a nightmare, since the August 10, 2020 storm barreled through. I've been living 2 years in a broken house and they don't care. They just do not care at all, said Sutton of Cedar Rapids, and they lie. Sutton is not alone. State insurance regulators have received 690 complaints over derecho-related insurance issues, according to a spokesman for the Iowa Insurance Division. But there are likely many more still in the fight in different ways, said Greg Usher, a Cedar Rapids lawyer who has been working for many homeowners impacted by the derecho. Roughly 4,700 out of 225,000 derecho-related claims filed by policyholders in Iowa still remain open, according to the State Insurance Division. There are probably hundreds and hundreds of homeowners like Sutton, Usher said, and there's probably hundreds and hundreds who have just given up entirely, thousands more who didn't know that they could push for more or how to go about doing it, and dozens paying me to help them kind of fight back. The 2020 storm, which featured straight-line winds that surpassed 140 miles per hour, covered 770 miles from South Dakota to Indiana over the course of 14 hours and caused $11.5 billion worth of damage to communities, farms, and crops, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Three deaths in Iowa were attributed to the storm. For homeowners such as Sutton, the derecho wreaked devastation upon his home, but the 2 years since have done the same to him, he said, causing him significant stress and pain. He said over the 2 years, the insurance company has sent 16 desk adjusters and 6 field adjusters to his house. And we're still fighting them, Sutton said. Every bill we have sent them, it's, oh, that's too expensive, we're not paying that. Sutton, a retired electrician, said he does not have the resources to hire an attorney. Understand my frustration. I know that I'm not going to get anywhere because I don't have the money to fight the insurance company. So how does that work? He said. It's been a nightmare. Usher said the clients he works with, and many of the homeowners who cannot afford a lawyer, frequently face what he described as stall tactics by insurance companies. There's a lot of, let's see if we can run out the clock slowly, bite off little chunks of claims paid out, but not anywhere near the whole thing that we need, Usher said. It's kind of a let's force the insured into a pay-to-play situation. Homeowners either roll over and just take what they're given and don't fight for everything they're entitled to because they don't have the financial or emotional wherewithal to keep putting up the fight. Or insurance companies say, all right, well, we have to make them earn it, so force them to pay for an appraisal, get an attorney involved along the way. They're going to force the insured homeowner and business owner to spend money. That, Usher says, creates a system where those with financial means can afford to take steps to make themselves and their homes whole, while those without are unable to do the same. The ones who have a nice little set of reserves and cash sitting around to pay for those services usually get taken care of after putting up that fight, Usher said. But a lot of the people who their house is the nicest thing they own, they don't have a ton of cash reserves because they've already spent it making repairs or just living paycheck to paycheck. They don't have that money sitting around to have somebody with expertise help them, and they're the ones who probably most need the help because they can't afford to pay for the repairs out of their own pockets. And there's still a lot of them. Insurance companies have paid over $3.6 billion to settle the more than 225,000 claims, according to the State Insurance Division. The numbers are unprecedented, a division spokesman said. The total includes payments that resulted from consumer complaints, which have reached more than $1.1 million, according to the division. Nothing is the same. 2 years later, homeowners still grapple with derecho damage by Marissa Payne. On August 10, 2020, as the sun beat down like any other summer day, Nicole Andrew gathered with a close-knit group of moms as their kids played in their northeast Cedar Rapids neighborhood, toothy grins hidden behind little masks, trying to make the best of things amid the spread of COVID-19. Suddenly, Andrew's neighbor, who closely monitors the news, emerged to warn the moms that storms were coming. A thick, almost black cloud hung overhead as she ran outside to pick up loose items. Sensing this would be a serious storm, she took her two children down to the basement and closed the door. 10 minutes into the rain, she heard a bang. Then the electricity went out. She opened the door to insulation pouring down her stairwell. "Be strong for the kids," she thought to herself. She eventually took them to her car in case the house came crashing down, and they didn't step outside until the rain stopped. When they finally came out, Andrew said it was clear their house was crushed. After dark that night, Andrew and her family carefully drove past fallen trees and downed power lines to stay with a local relative. The derecho's hurricane-force wind gusts had toppled a tree right into their house, rendering it one of the more than 1,000 properties the city of Cedar Rapids placarded to mark as "Do Not Occupy." Andrew shuffled her kids around from a relative's basement to her mom's house, then to a hotel, an apartment, and back to the basement once more, while continuing to pay the mortgage on their uninhabitable home. Most of the belongings they could salvage remained in storage. A fully furnished two-bedroom rental unit at Granite Valley Apartments on C Avenue Northeast remained their home when the first anniversary of the storm came in 2021, and ultimately until May 31st. "Everybody else was able to move on," said Andrew, 39, her voice wavering with emotion, "and not us." Ever since that fateful day the storm tore through town, Andrew and her children's lives were drastically altered as she battled contractors, worked with attorneys, and navigated her insurance company to ultimately get a $205,000 sum paid out to repair her destroyed house. About 2 weeks ago, just shy of the second anniversary of the storm, Andrew and her two kids finally moved back into their home with a new roof and completely remodeled modern interior. Scanning city streets, it appears Cedar Rapids area residents are largely on the path to recovery from the 2020 derecho that pummeled Linn County, the epicenter of the costliest thunderstorm in modern U.S. history. Where blue tarps sat atop buildings, there now are new roofs and shingles. Forestry crews grind stumps where stately oaks and maples stood for generations, making way for citizens to replant saplings that will in time morph into a lush emerald canopy. Despite the visible progress, the derecho still looms large over a small but sizable number of Cedar Rapids area property owners every day, while their homes have only recently been fixed or still await repairs through no fault of their own. Those who couldn't swiftly make repairs to storm-damaged properties say their efforts stalled as they were swindled by out-of-town contractors, waited in limbo for insurance settlements, hired labor while contending with high demand around town for the same services, and grappled with lagging supply chains or cost spikes. Now moving on to some political news. Iowa Republicans jump to Trump's defense after FBI search of home. GOP officials denounce unprecedented raid at ex-president's Mar-a-Lago estate. By Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa Republicans jumped to former President Donald Trump's defense after the FBI's search for documents as part of an investigation into whether he took classified records from the White House to his Florida estate. Some quickly denounced the Monday search by the FBI of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida, where agents executed a search warrant for classified documents, the Associated Press reported. The Department of Justice must immediately explain their justification for this unprecedented raid, Marion Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson tweeted Tuesday. A Republican majority will provide rigorous oversight of the Biden administration and ensure they are serving the American people, not targeting them, Hinson tweeted. The Miami Herald reported agents obtained a search warrant from a federal magistrate judge in West Palm Beach to get dozens of boxes allegedly containing classified material that Trump had taken to his home when he left the White House. A source close to the investigation told the Miami Herald the FBI was able to show probable cause because Trump and his lawyers had already turned over classified documents sought by the National Archives and Records Administration, and agents suspected that Trump was unlawfully holding other classified documents from his presidency in his private club and residence at Mar-a-Lago. Some of the materials Trump took included letters and notes from foreign leaders, such as North Korea's Kim Jong-un, the Washington Post reported. Trump and his allies, including Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman, sought to cast the search as a weaponization of the criminal justice system and a Democratic-driven effort to keep the former president from winning another term in 2024, though the White House said it had no prior knowledge and current FBI Director Christopher Wray was appointed by Trump, the AP reported. Fellow Iowa House GOP members Marionette Miller-Meeks of Ottumwa and Randy Feenstra of Hull also denounced the FBI's search. Feenstra called the FBI's search an unprecedented escalation of the use of law enforcement against a former president. Our justice system should be consistent, fair, and transparent, Feenstra tweeted. The FBI must immediately provide a full accounting of facts. The American people deserve answers. Miller-Meeks tweeted, it's time for Washington to focus on the crimes happening at our border and cities, energy independence, and not wasting taxpayer dollars investigating political rivals. Trump ally and Iowa's senior Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said conservatives have reason to be skeptical of Trump-related investigations. Transparency brings accountability, and if the FBI and DOJ aren't transparent about raiding a former president's home, they risk further damaging their credibility, Grassley tweeted. Fellow Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst said the American people deserve answers now. A totally unprecedented action by the DOJ and FBI, the same agencies who labeled parents domestic terrorists and sat on the sidelines while justices were threatened and churches were vandalized, Ernst tweeted. While no former president has ever been the subject of an FBI search of their home, former White House aides say Trump repeatedly and flagrantly mishandled classified documents. Multiple federal laws govern the handling of classified records and sensitive government documents, including statutes that make it a crime to remove such material and retain it at an unauthorized location. There's no revenge happening here, Iowa Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, Democrat of Coralville, tweeted. There is no deep state acting here. There is a former president who appears to have broken multiple laws. There is an AG who is enforcing the law. That is what is happening. Don't let them gaslight you. Patch program aid still available. $800,000 left, mostly for mobile homes, by Marissa Payne. In the months after the derecho's 140-mile-per-hour wind gusts battered Linn County, Renee Moody of Cedar Rapids said she struggled to find a contractor available to help fix her roof. Eventually, rain trickled in. By the late fall and into early winter 2020, snow sprinkled in, too. The precipitation caused water and mold damage upstairs in her three-bedroom house, so she started to live mostly on the first level, venturing upstairs to use the restroom. Moody said her insurance company gave her $14,000 in December 2020, but that sum was enough to cover only the roof. As she looked for assistance to cover the new damages stemming from the storm, her applications for individual assistance through the Federal Emergency Management Agency and a Small Business Administration loan weren't accepted. If repairs weren't made soon, she considered moving in with her adult children nearby and giving her home back to the bank. Waypoint Services responded to her last-ditch effort to get help and connected her with the Patch Program, an effort of the East Central Iowa Council of Governments, United Way of East Central Iowa, Matthew 25, and others to help Linn County residents struggling to afford repairs in the wake of the derecho. Moody said she received a $35,000 five-year forgivable loan this spring to get her home back in shape and is pleased with the work contractors and Matthew 25 did throughout the process. I thank God because I had just retired, Moody said. I was on a fixed income. I feel very fortunate because if I wouldn't have been accepted into that program, I probably wouldn't have been able to stay in my home very much longer. 2 years still is a long time to go through a lot of damage to your house and stay in it. Moody is among the 182 households Patch has assisted to date. So far, the entities involved have obligated $2.5 million in funding. The City of Cedar Rapids and Linn County each awarded $1 million to the program, and private donors have contributed $1.3 million. About $800,000 in aid remains for qualifying residents of single-family homes and mobile homes that sustained damage in the 2020 derecho. Most of the assistance that remains will support mobile home residents. As funds dwindle, likely by the end of the year, officials urged anyone who may need aid to apply quickly. I think a lot of the success of Patch has been having just a nimble, compassionate group of partners, said Brenner Myers, Matthew 25's construction director. Before the Patch program was underway, Matthew 25 assisted about 130 households with generators, tarps, and minor repairs. Meyer said most people have settled by now with their insurance companies or know they won't get any further with that process, sending them searching for other means of assistance. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 10th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Richard Dick Lee Alberts of Cedar Rapids, 86, passed away at the Crossing River Health Care Center in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, on Monday, August 8, 2022, surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, August 12th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A funeral mass will be offered at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 13th, at St. Matthew's Catholic Church, with Father Douglas Loki presiding. Interment to follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Richard was born on November 5, 1935 in Newhall, Iowa, growing up in Norway, Iowa. He was the son of the late Joseph and Elsie Weichmann Alberts. Richard attended Norway High School. After high school, Richard enlisted into the U.S. Marine Corps, where he was stationed in Hawaii, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and San Diego. On August 30, 1973, Richard married the love of his life, Karen Flannery, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. In the 1970s, Richard owned the Safari Lounge. For over 50 years, Richard was a pipe fitter belonging to the Pipe Fitters Union Local 125 and spent the majority of his time working for the Modern Piping Company. Richard was a member of St. Matthew's Parish in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he served as a Eucharistic minister. He enjoyed trap shooting, fishing, Hawkeye sports, playing cards, and watching and attending Chicago Cubs games. He especially loved spending time with his kids and grandkids, whether it was fishing, coaching, playing basketball, baseball, puzzles, or traveling. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in his name to a charity of one's choice or especially close to his heart, Balance Autism. Waguyu S. Ferris, 42, of Coralville, died Friday, August 5, 2022, of an apparent drowning. Funeral services are pending at this time for Friday, August 12. For a complete obituary to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral Home and Cremation Service website at gayandchia.com. Robert R. Bob Med, 95, of Iowa City, passed away Sunday, August 7, 2022, at Briarwood Healthcare Center in Iowa City. A celebration of life will be scheduled for the near future when all can come together to celebrate Bob's life. Burial will follow at New Windsor Cemetery, New Windsor, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the New Windsor Cemetery, care of John Carlson, P.O. Box 263, New Windsor, Illinois, 61465. Thoughts may be shared with the family at lensingfuneral.com. Mabel Ursula Rouse, 90, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away Sunday, August 7, 2022, at her home, surrounded by her family. The family will host a celebration of life at 2 p.m. Saturday, August 20th, at the Summit View Village Community Room at 100 Hames Street, Southwest Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids, assisted the family. Mabel was born May 15, 1932, in Dubuque, Iowa, the daughter of Arthur and Florence Hulls Nelson. She graduated from Wilson High School in Cedar Rapids. Mabel met Mike Rouse in 1950 while he was serving in the U.S. Navy. They met at Danceland Ballroom, and 1 year later, on September 15, 1951, the couple was united in marriage in Marion, Iowa. She worked for the Cedar Rapids Police Department as a records technician until she retired in 1992. Mabel was a fan of watching Westerns. She will be dearly missed by her friends and family. Memorials may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Mabel at murdochfuneralhomes.com under obituaries. Marilyn Jean Berglund, 93, of Iowa City, Iowa, passed away peacefully at her home at Legacy Point Senior Living in Iowa City on August 4, 2022. Marilyn was born March 3, 1929 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to Carl Johnson and Maud Bowman Johnson. She spent her younger days growing up in Minneapolis, later attending McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, for art. She married Earl Marvin Berglund on May 7, 1949 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. They first lived in Boulder, Colorado, before settling in Iowa City, Iowa, while starting their family. Marilyn led a very active life running the household while raising seven children. The family enjoyed camping together in the Boundary Waters and spending time at their cabin in southern Canada. Marilyn was a very talented woman. She was a gifted artist, quilter, seamstress, and cook, passing along those skills to many of her children and grandchildren. She enjoyed helping several with their 4-H projects and teaching them to quilt. She was a proud Scandinavian woman who shared her heritage through her rosemailing painting and cooking. Marilyn had a love for nature, and it was reflected in many of her beautiful paintings. A favorite spot to visit was Kent Park in rural Johnson County. Marilyn loved her family deeply and enjoyed spending time with them, affectionately known as Mama Marilyn. She was an avid crossword puzzler, loved going to the opera and ballet, and enjoyed the occasional margarita. At Marilyn's request, there will be no public service at this time, but a memorial to be held at a later time. To share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral Home Cremation Services website at gayandchia.com. Grace Margaret Crippen, 88, of Manchester, Iowa, passed away on Monday, August 8, 2022, at the Regional Medical Center in Manchester. Memorial service, noon, Monday, August 15th, at the Stone Church in Manchester, Iowa, with Pastor Joe Camp officiating. Visitation, 10 a.m. to noon, Monday, August 15th, at the Stone Church in Manchester. Interment will be at a later date. Online condolences may be sent to leonard-mullerfh.com. Mercedes Galvin, of Iowa City, age 29, died Sunday, August 7th, 2022. A service of remembrance will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, August 12th at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City, with Father Ed Fitzpatrick officiating. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. prior to the funeral. Family committal services will be held at Memory Garden Cemetery at a later date. Memorials may be directed to an educational fund for her children, AJ and Gianna. Mercedes was born July 13, 1993, in Iowa City, the daughter of Marco and Elizabeth Perez Galvin. Mercedes was a graduate of West Liberty High School, where she was a cheerleader and received a degree as a medical assistant from Hamilton Technical College. She was employed at Acupuncture of Iowa. Mercedes was a loving mom. She loved life, her children, and the outdoors. She will be greatly missed by all those she touched. Dr. Gary R. Dundee, 83, of Center Point, Iowa, died Monday, August 8, 2022. Funeral Mass, 2 p.m. Friday, August 12th at St. Mary Catholic Church, 402 Ash Avenue, Urbana, Iowa. Celebration of Life, 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 12th at American Legion Post 297, 902 Main Street, Center Point. Burial will take place at a later date at Cherry Mound Cemetery near Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point is assisting the family. Gary was born July 11, 1939, in Iowa City, the son of Leland and Annabelle Cahalan Dundee. He graduated from St. Patrick High School in Waukon, Iowa, and went on to obtain his doctorate degree in dentistry from the University of Iowa. Gary was united in marriage to Carol Scheel on November 26, 1960, in Independence, Iowa. He was a member of the Center Point Booster Club, Center Point School Board, Iowa Dental Association, and Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Church was very important to Gary. He loved golfing, farming, playing cards, and spending time with his grandchildren. Gary was on the Center Point High School chain gang for 50 years. Memorials may be directed to the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy or area ambulance. Cora Duane Stein of Columbia, Tennessee, left this world suddenly on August 5, 2022, at age 51. He was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Corey was a talented guitarist. He moved to Nashville to pursue a musical career, and he played in several bands in Tennessee, Iowa, and Illinois. Throughout his life, he never lost his passion for music. Corey had many hobbies. Some of them include bird watching, photography, and fast cars. He loved spending time with his sons and enjoyed building Lego sets, playing video games, hiking in the Smoky Mountains, fishing, and riding the ATV. Corey was gifted with the ability to make anyone feel welcomed. His talent earned him many awards and trips with Verizon, being in the top 5 performers in the country. He became ordained and married 2 of his great friends. He was a counselor and a clown with an infectious, memorable laugh and made it a point to make people smile. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, August 12th at St. Peter's Episcopal Church, 311 West 7th Street, Columbia, Tennessee, 38401. Graveside service will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 13th at Polk Memorial Gardens, 6465 Trotwood Avenue, Columbia, Tennessee, 38401. Arlen M. Gerhold, 87, of Atkins, was called to his heavenly home on Sunday, August 7, 2022, surrounded by his loving children. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, August 12th at St. Stephen's Lutheran Church in Atkins, with Reverend Jeff Schonbacher officiating. Interment will be held at St. Stephen's Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 11th at St. Stephen's Lutheran Church in Atkins. Arlen was born on June 4, 1935, to Carl and Emma Happel Gerhold on the family farm in Atkins, Iowa. He attended St. Stephen's Lutheran Church and graduated from Atkins High School in 1952. After working at Midland Forge for 2 years, he enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1956 and was stationed at Fort Lewis in Washington. He was honorably discharged as a sergeant in 1962. While enlisted, he pitched on the U.S. Army's baseball team and continued playing for the Atkins baseball team after being discharged. Arlen was united in marriage on February 11, 1961, to Barbara Sandler at Trinity Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. In addition to farming near Atkins, he worked for Cryovac and Schwitters. After becoming a realtor in 1972, he worked for Bickel & Byers, Byers Happel, Landmark, First Realty, and Iowa Realty. He never forgot a name or face, even after his retirement, after 35 years as a realtor. Together, Arlen and Barbara enjoyed spending time in their garden and loved to play cards with their card club members. They also enjoyed many family vacations to Branson and the Ozarks area in Missouri. He will be deeply missed by all who knew him. Joanna Linscheid, 87, of Morgantown, West Virginia, passed away on Saturday, August 6, 2022, at her home. Joanna was born on July 5, 1935, in St. Joseph, Missouri, a daughter of the late Bert O'Connor and Vina Edgington O'Connor. Joanna possessed a wide range of interests. She enjoyed sewing and quilting. She loved to read, studying genealogy, and was a history buff. Music was also a big part of her life, and along with her husband, Luann, they loved to sing for church services. She was a Bible study fellowship discussion group leader for several years. Private graveside services were held at 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 9th at Beverly Hills Cemetery, with the Reverend Kevin Kane officiated. McCullough Funeral Home was in charge of arrangements, and online condolences may be sent to the family at McCullough.com, and McCullough is spelled M-C-C-U-L-L-A. Richard L. Clark of Las Vegas, Nevada. A celebration of life will be held for Richard Clark Saturday, August 13th, 2022, beginning at 1 p.m. at the home of Merton Bill Bowers, 203 Old Lincoln Highway, Mount Vernon, Iowa. He died of cardiac arrest in March of 2022 after a courageous three-month hospitalization in Las Vegas, Nevada. Richard was born the second child of 14 children on December 16, 1939. He attended Rosedale Rural School through seventh grade and graduated from Mount Vernon High School in 1958. Following graduation, he joined the U.S. Navy. He was stationed at Naval Air Station Whidbey Island off the shore of Washington State. He was assigned to electronic school and then as a Navy plane captain on an A-3P Sky Warrior twin jet powered strategic bomber built by Douglas Aircraft Company, designated the Whale. Richard worked as a proud iron worker on many elaborate casinos in Las Vegas and welcomed friends and family to his home. Richard was married to Diane Toberlin in 1959. Dewey A. Peterson, 75, of Winthrop, formerly of Ely, Iowa, died at his home in Winthrop on Sunday, August 7, 2022. A celebration of life is being planned from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday, August 20th at the Woodpecker Lodge at Pinnacon Ridge Park in Central City, Iowa. Dwayne Joseph Krobe, 80, of Shoeyville, passed away on Sunday, August 7, 2022 at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County, after a 2.5-year-long battle with cancer. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 11, 2022, at St. Mary Catholic Church of Solon. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 12, 2022, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Solon, with Father Charles Flading presiding. Burial will be at St. Peter and Paul Cemetery in rural Solon. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon are in charge of arrangements. Dwayne was born December 8, 1941, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the son of Joseph and Evelyn Achenbach Krobe. Extended family became a very important part of Dwayne's early life when, at the age of 3, he lost his mother to pneumonia. Growing up on farms in the Lisbon area and being around machinery sparked an early desire in him to learn more about how things work, and he decided that he wanted to be the first in his family to go to college. On February 24, 1962, Duane was united in marriage to Margaret Midge Hewitt at St. Anne's Catholic Church in East Moline, Illinois. Kids came along quickly and delayed Duane's college degree as he worked to support their growing family. It was a frequent cycle of a semester of school followed by a semester or two of work, and college's attendant often had to fit around Duane's employment. After transferring back to the University of Iowa, he graduated with a BS of Mechanical Engineering degree. He was very proud of the fact that he was able to graduate from college in 1967 debt-free. He received his engineer in training, EIT, certification, and later his professional engineer license in 1974. Duane always aspired to owning his own business, and in 1979 ventured out on his own by purchasing an existing sales rep company, thus moving from behind the desk to calling on the customer. With his engineering background in foundries, he quickly changed the direction of the company to include custom design and manufacturing of custom machinery for the foundry industry, thus giving life to Foundry Equipment Company. This business grew to include the entire family over the years, along with many valued employees that contributed to the company's success. Throughout his working career, he also displayed his ambition and love for carpentry and construction, both passed on to him by his father, by building three of the family homes, as well as a workshop that would allow him to continue his passions of car restoration and woodworking during retirement. Memorials may be directed to St. Mary Catholic Church of Solon or Optimist International Foundation. That concludes today's obituaries. We'll move on to the editorial page and read today's Gazette editorial. The title is Recovery, Preparation, Continue. It's been 2 years since a derecho tore through the region with winds clocked as high as 140 miles per hour, damaging and destroying homes and businesses while decimating the region's tree canopy. Recovery from the storm, assessment of the community response, and preparation for the next natural disaster continue in Cedar Rapids and in surrounding affected communities. The $37 million 10-year relief partnership between the City of Cedar Rapids and Trees Forever has guided the planting of 2,470 trees so far along city streets, in parks, and other public property. Another 446 trees have been adopted by private property owners, with another 500 tree adoption drive set for this fall. Private fundraising efforts for the ambitious project have collected $2.8 million so far, along with the city's commitment of $1 million annually. Next year, Relief will recruit neighborhood tree captains to guide and encourage tree planting in neighborhoods throughout the city. Monarch Research also is spearheading efforts to provide trees to property owners after a storm that knocked down 670,000 trees in Cedar Rapids and 1 million across Linn County. Cedar Rapids is using portions of its share of Federal American Rescue Plan funding for the PATCH program, repairing derecho-damaged homes, to fund new affordable housing and to match community development block grants for disaster recovery. Funding also will assist with tree planting, watering, stump removal, and for generators at public facilities such as schools and libraries. Nonprofits critical to disaster response and recovery can also access funding for generators. Perhaps the most critical ongoing effort is to assess the region's response to the disaster with the goal of being better prepared for the next one. In just the past 8 months, three derechos have crossed through Iowa, and a changing climate is certain to spawn more extreme weather in the years ahead. A recently released outside assessment of community responses to the 2020 derecho found that local communities need to beef up communication and information sharing, including the coordinated use of social media, and create shared plans for disaster response. More training and regular response drills are needed, and larger communities must stand ready to assist smaller communities that lack resources. All of these efforts will require community support and participation. Just as area residents came together to help each other in the wake of the storm, the spirit of cooperation and involvement is needed to strengthen our communities for times in the future when the skies darken and storms approach. For all of the damage done, we can make the derecho's lasting legacy a painful moment that led us to create stronger, more resilient communities that can meet the next challenge. There is one letter to the editor today. It is from Bernie Hayes, a Cedar Rapids candidate for Iowa Senate District 39. And the headline is, One Question Must Be Answered in Abortion Debate. Kansans were asked the wrong question. It's the same question that the 1973 Supreme Court failed to address in its abortion ruling, and yet it made a ruling anyway. It's the same question that neither the U.S. or Kansas constitutions or any of many other states do not address as well. To this day, this question is avoided, and still this question remains the key essential and fundamental question that, when answered, makes the rest of the Rubik's Cube squares fall into place. Some would say this question is above their pay grade, but it is a question we encounter every day and seem to have no real qualm, young or old, for recognizing when it is and when it isn't. The question that needs to be answered is, when does life begin? When a heart stops beating, we pronounce a person dead. Can we pronounce them alive when we detect one? And once we establish that the heartbeat indicates life, we can address the lawful implications of rights and protections. In the land of the free and the home of the brave, may we have the courage to answer the right question first. Our founders did by signing off on recognizing we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, and they began the list with life. Perhaps we should too. Again, that is a letter to the editor from Bernie Hayes, a Cedar Rapids candidate for Iowa Senate District 39. Going back to some more derecho news, this one's titled, Governments Wait for Second Half of FEMA Aid. Most of the local $100 million ask is for derecho debris removal. By Gage Miskimen. About half the roughly $100 million in aid to local governments sought by Cedar Rapids, Marion, Hiawatha, Robbins, and Linn County in the aftermath of the 2020 derecho has been received so far from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The majority of the big-ticket items are for the costs of debris removal and cleanup from the August 10, 2020 storm. Some local communities have reached out to members of Congress or consultants for help navigating the FEMA reimbursement process, as the agency responds to a much higher level of declared disasters across the nation besides the derecho. In the last 2 years, FEMA has responded to over 150 declared disasters across the country. In comparison, the average of annual disasters in the 1960s was 18. The agency has seen high turnover despite adding thousands of workers over the last 5 years. Linn County Risk Manager Steve Estenson and Finance Director Don Gindrich both said they've been frustrated with the process. The county received $11 million in reimbursement for derecho debris cleanup last month, and another $16.8 million has been obligated to be paid. FEMA said 11 county projects at $3.8 million remain to be obligated. I'm very surprised about the delays, Gindrich said. I don't know if it's because FEMA is spread too thin with other disasters in other parts of the country, but to be waiting 2 years with some of these things, I cannot believe it. It's a lot to ask of any government entity to be out $20 million for 2 years. We were told at one time we would be pretty much fully reimbursed in January 2021. My frustration is not having FEMA staff on site to work with us on this, Estenson said. They're trying to do everything remotely with their staff. And when you're trying to identify and document your damages to them, it's hard to do that with just pictures. And, for example, the folks at FEMA are using Google Earth to measure feet for a damaged gutter, while I have an architect here on the ground doing it, and there are discrepancies. To request aid from FEMA, local governments must file for assistance within 30 days of the area being declared a disaster area. FEMA goes through the project list and obligates funding to the state. Local jurisdictions, such as cities and counties, are considered sub-applicants under the state, so when projects are approved for reimbursement, FEMA obligates funding to the state, which then distributes the funds locally. In Cedar Rapids, the city has filed 18 projects with FEMA, including for debris removal, building damages, and waterway work, according to FEMA External Affairs Director Christiana Sanford. 15 of those have been obligated. Cedar Rapids officials estimate derecho recovery will total about $85 million, City Finance Director Casey Drew said. The city expects $60 million to $65 million in reimbursement for FEMA-eligible costs. Sanford said one of the three remaining city projects was obligated Tuesday at $690,000, and a $24.5 million debris removal project will be obligated by the end of September. Relief Plan gets $2.8 million in donations after derecho. Hall Perrine, Alliant, Collins, ITC Midwest among top donors. By Brittany Miller. As of the two-year anniversary of the derecho that raised 65% of Cedar Rapids tree canopy, donors have contributed more than $2.8 million toward the Relief Cedar Rapids plan that guides tree planting efforts throughout the city. Marion-based nonprofit Trees Forever, which led the fundraising campaign, said in a statement that the top donors include the Hall Perrine Foundation, $900,000, Alliant Energy, $550,000, Collins Aerospace, $250,000, ITC Midwest, $200,000, and Confluence Landscape Architects, $200,000. The $2.8 million is in addition to $10 million already committed over 10 years by the City of Cedar Rapids, Trees Forever said. By last year's one-year anniversary of the storm, private investors had contributed $1 million. The Gazette reported last year, and corporate and individual donors had raised over $11 million for the relief plan. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 10th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.